Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie covering KHSC's use of AI as a diagnostic tool.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news at cfrc.ca.
Kingston Health Sciences Center is officially the first hospital in Canada to implement a groundbreaking artificial intelligence tool used to diagnose coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is the most common form of cardiovascular disease and the leading cause of death worldwide. It occurs when the coronary arteries become narrowed or blocked, reducing blood flow to the heart. Thanks to a $100,000 donation from local donor Steven Sorensen, KHSC has introduced HeartFlow, a revolutionary AI-based technology that's transforming cardiac care. HeartFlow enables radiologists and cardiologists to measure blood flow through a patient's coronary arteries using a non-invasive CT scan. Dr. Omar Islam, head of diagnostic radiology at KHSC, explained what the diagnostic process for coronary artery disease has looked like until now.
Patients with stable chest pain typically undergo a CT scan of their heart to look at the coronary arteries, which are the blood vessels that supply oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle. And a narrowing of those blood vessels, especially severe narrowing of those blood vessels, can be significant and may be precursor to that patient having a heart attack in the future. So those patients are typically triaged by a coronary CT angiogram to look at those blood vessels, and it's dye that's injected into the veins, and we get a 3D map of the blood vessels. So that's how it's done. And then those patients, if they have severe narrowing on the coronary CTA, are referred potentially on to the cath lab, so the angio suite, so undergo a minor surgical procedure where that narrowing is confirmed. And if the narrowing is confirmed, then a blood flow analysis is performed, looking at the reduction in blood flow through those vessels. And reduction in blood flow is actually the most important determinant of the risk of having a heart attack. So if the blood flow is reduced, that means there's reduced delivery of oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle, and then that patient is at risk for a heart attack. So it's not really the narrowing that's most important, it's the reduction in blood flow. So we cannot assess in a typical situation the blood flow on CT. We can only assess the narrowing of the blood vessel, and so those patients typically have to be sent to the cath lab for the minor surgical procedure to look at blood flow.
Now, using the AI capabilities of HeartFlow, physicians can measure blood flow directly from a CT scan. If the flow is normal, the patient avoids an invasive procedure entirely.
Yeah, so HeartFlow is a really cool new technology. So it's a non-invasive technology that uses those CT scan images, and it extrapolates blood flow from the narrowing in those blood vessels. So in essence, it gives the doctor the same information that they would otherwise need to get from the cath lab doing that minor surgical procedure. And now we get that information non-invasively from the CT scan images themselves. So it really is a one-stop shop for assessment of the coronary arteries and risk of heart disease and strokes.
For patients, this means faster answers and better care with less risk.
It's beneficial for the patients in many ways. First of all, it's non-invasive. So a cath lab is a minor surgical procedure, and patients have to come into the hospital for day surgery, and they have to have a puncture in their groin vessels or in their arm vessels, and they have to have dye and have pictures of their heart taken under radiation. And so, you know, these procedures are performed every day throughout the country. They're extremely safe, but, you know, there's still a very small risk of complications such as bleeding or stroke. And of course, no one wants to undergo an invasive procedure if they don't have to. So in, you know, up to 30% of patients, heart flow analysis avoids that patient from having to undergo that invasive angio procedure. Also, because the heart flow is applied when the patient has their CAT scan, they get the answer, the diagnosis, within a few minutes to a few hours, rather than having to wait weeks or days for the catheter procedure to occur. So they get an answer immediately. And because they get that answer right away, they can potentially get started on treatment and medications right after their CT scan with heart flow, rather than having to wait until after the results of the cath lab. Furthermore, there's less, obviously, radiation and contrast dye exposure because they're only getting a CT scan. They're not getting an angio procedure in the cath lab, so they avoid radiation and contrast dye. This is especially useful in some elderly patients or other patients who have diabetes and kidney disease, where the risk of kidney malfunction is higher with repeated contrast dye exposure. So in those patients, this test is very useful because we don't have to give the patients contrast dye twice.
This technology is also a game changer for healthcare providers and the healthcare system.
This is really, really an amazing tool from the healthcare efficiency perspective. The fact that the heart flow triages the right patients to go onwards to cath lab is really important because it reduces hospital admissions and procedure backlogs in the cath lab. There's, you know, we have long wait lists everywhere in our healthcare system. So by triaging the right patient to undergo the right test, this saves time and, of course, avoids patients from having to undergo these unnecessary procedures. Therefore, the time in the cath lab can be directed to patients who actually need to be there. It's also leads to better outcomes because of timely treatment for those who need it. And for those who don't need the procedure, heart flow provides the reassurance that their blood flow is not reduced and is not significant, and therefore they don't need to go on to further testing.
Heart flow is now fully operational at KHSC.
So far, so good. We plan on collecting data from all the patients who undergo cardiac CT and heart flow analysis. We expect approximately 100 patients over the next 12 months to undergo the heart flow analysis. So we'll have a lot more information, coming up in the next year.
Teams at KHSC will be studying the technology's effectiveness in Canadian patients, with the goal of publishing their findings and inspiring adoption in hospitals across the country.
This technology, although it is new, it is a game changer. It works. It's been validated across multiple centers in the United States and Europe. We are fortunate to be the first site in Canada, all of Canada, to be using it. But we do hope that our use provides recognition and is newsworthy enough so that government officials, including Ministry of Health in Ontario, take notice and realize the value in, not just for individual patients, but for the healthcare system in implementation of this technology broadly across all sites in Ontario. We do feel that there's a big role for artificial intelligence in the healthcare system to work alongside the physicians, the administrators, and the staff to increase efficiencies, provide more accurate diagnosis, faster diagnosis, and improve the quality of care. We see AI as a tool that augments the care that we can provide to our patients.
This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about a $50,000 grant given to the town of Greater Napanee to help with emergency preparedness.
Thank you, Jesse. Ontario's Minister of Emergency Preparedness and Response, Jill Dunlop, was in Greater Dauphiny last week to announce a $50,000 grant for emergency preparedness. Dunlop joined Greater Dauphiny Deputy Mayor Brian Calver, Hastings, Lennox, and Addington Member of Provincial Parliament Rick Brazy, and town officials to unveil new equipment purchased through the Provincial Community Emergency Preparedness Grant, which provides funding to help communities and organizations buy emergency supplies, equipment, and services. The announcement took place next to a display featuring an emergency response trailer, cot, signage, and other preparedness items and equipment in the parking lot in front of the municipal office building at 99 Advance Avenue in Napanee. In the 2023 provincial budget, the Ontario government earmarked $110 million over 3 years to strengthen emergency preparedness in Ontario. The grants fund supplies, equipment, and services that range from $5,000 to $50,000. Minister Dunlop explained that the government grant has been used so far over the past 2 years to provide a total of $10 million to 227 municipalities, First Nations, and community organizations to improve their emergency management preparation and response. The municipality is also procuring a generator and an emergency evacuation trailer, as well as educational items such as banners, flyers, and door hangers to raise awareness about emergency preparedness. After the announcement, Greater Dauphiny Community Emergency Management Coordinator Erin Tyers discussed a program she is bringing to area schools to teach children about emergency preparedness so they can implement skills and make kits for their homes in case of a disaster. A part of that program will now include some of the new equipment to show kids what the essential needs are during an emergency. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with a story from the LJR reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the impending removal of Gananoque's King Street Bridge.
Thank you, Dinah. After months of debate and some community outcry, Gananoque is set to begin removing the King Street Pedestrian Bridge on September 2nd. The nearly century-old bridge has been closed to the public since mid-2022 due to safety concerns, and the demolition project is expected to last approximately 17 weeks. Strong Brothers Contracting will carry out the removal, with drivers and pedestrians advised to expect intermittent traffic delays and detours. The town urges everyone to follow posted signs and drive cautiously near the work zone. Updates on the project will be provided throughout construction. The bridge's removal follows a contentious vote by Town Council in June, when a narrow 4-3 majority approved demolition. Deputy Mayor Vicky Leakey and Councillors Matt Harper, Patrick Kirkby, and David Osmond voted in favor, while Mayor John Beddoes, Anne-Marie Coyner, and Colin Brown opposed. Mayor Beddoes explored the possibility of a veto, citing potential impacts on future infrastructure funding, but legal advice confirmed he could not legally block Council's decision under Ontario's strong mayor powers provisions. The vote has sparked ongoing controversy in Gananoque, with a petition to preserve the bridge gathering nearly 900 signatures. Local advocacy group Save Our King Street Pedestrian Bridge, led by John W. Taylor and Carolyn Young, has argued that repairing the bridge for pedestrian use could cost less than demolition. Tensions escalated again during an August 12th council meeting when Councillor Osmond demanded an apology from Mayor Beddoes for comments in a recent news story that he said publicly undermined council. Despite the debates, demolition contracts have been signed, and the project is moving forward, marking the end of a long and heated chapter in Gananoque's local infrastructure history.
And thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the potential creation of a large-scale solar farm in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. Landowners in Loyalist Township have already showed interest in a proposal brought forth by Westbridge Renewable Energy for a large-scale solar farm. The proposed project would be located on approximately 800 acres of private land near Switzerville. With a target operation date in May of 2030, the project would be capable of supplying energy to 20,000 homes. According to the township's zoning and official plan policies, Loyalist is recognized as having some of the highest photovoltaic potential in the province. Westbridge Renewable Energy is a Canadian-based developer focused on utility-scale solar photovoltaic projects. They currently have operations in Canada, USA, the UK, and Europe. Director and Executive Chair of Westbridge Renewable Energy, Scott Kelly, explains the components of the project and what the site would look like.
Components would really be the solar PV photovoltaic panels in a rural environment, quiet, generating solar energy and clean electricity to connect to the grid and supply to the local community and industry. In terms of what it would look like, typically rows of 10-meter solar panels, some very small substations and inverters, and gravel access roads and perimeter fencing. We try to keep a fairly low, as much of a low impact as possible, and protect the local environment as much as possible. And it's very key in our site criteria and our development.
Kelly speaks about the proposed site south of the 401 near Switzerville.
This is subject to change. We're going through quite a bit of environmental and other consultation work, working with the local municipalities and trying to refine and fine-tune this.
Kelly explains how the company chooses an ideal site.
The way we look at projects and the way we would select an ideal site is obviously, is there availability on the local transmission line to add new power? And can we connect to it in an economic way and transfer and transmit the clean energy in an economical and efficient way? We look for non-prime agricultural land where there's very good solar radiance, meaning the ability to generate an excellent amount of energy that makes the project economical. Where there's definite landowner interest, we see the landowners as very much as our partners. And where there is municipal and community support, and very much where we're working within the guidelines and the policies of the municipalities and the communities that we are partnering with.
Kelly notes how the company collaborates with the communities they work within.
All of our projects are very much a collaboration with the communities in which we are working with. We spend a lot of time with the municipalities, with the local landowners, working within the regulations and the environment that we're working in. Every project is unique, and we look at ourselves as long-term partners with the community and do our very best to benefit the community in every way we can.
Kelly explains how the company establishes a community benefit fund for communities they work with.
In terms of adding back to the community, it's something we very much take as part of our project. Every project that we build and plan and bring to market includes a small fund that would essentially share some of the revenue and some of the benefit and some of the funding and money that comes from this project with the local municipality.
COO and director with Westbridge Renewable Energy, Margaret McKenna, speaks about the lifespan of the project.
The typical lifespan can be kind of anywhere between 35 and 50 years, depending on whether the panels are replaced and how many times they are replaced during the life of the project. There will be a decommissioning plan. It's required as part of the renewable energy approval process. And we anticipate that there would be coordination and consultation with the Loyalist Planning Department in terms of what that looks like.
Kelly explains the timeline of their proposal and their steps going forward.
We did have a pre-consultation meeting at the end of July. We have met with several landowners. I've met with several of them personally in the last few weeks myself, and we're planning an open house just around the corner on the 25th of August at the Odessa Agricultural Society Fairground to discuss face-to-face with anyone in the community who'd like to attend. And we'll be back in September with much more finalized plans and be coming to the council for some support. And the final submission is October 16th.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN Coburg, Dan Jones, with a story about the annual Parkinson's Canada Superwalk fundraiser.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Coburg, Ontario. Coburg is one of several locations in Canada hosting a Parkinson Canada Superwalk. The event is to raise awareness and funds for research and support. Caroline Thornton, ambassador for Parkinson Canada, is living with the non-curable disease. She is encouraging everyone to get involved.
The Superwalk is the annual fundraiser for Parkinson Canada, which raises money to provide research and support to people living with Parkinson's and their caregivers.
Okay, so let's talk about the Northumberland Walk. And part of this event that I've noticed is there's an element called the Walk in a Box Toolkit. Let's talk about that. What is it and why is that being implemented in this event?
The toolkit that we're talking about is a way for people who want to walk in that program to prepare for themselves and to get ready to go and have all the pieces that would be necessary. So they have a registration form, they have information about the walk, they have perhaps a shirt or a t-shirt or something they can wear to promote the walk and to show that they're in the walk. It's just a way of helping people get ready and get into the walk easily. And they have a way to contact anybody if they need additional support.
What is Parkinson's disease in general?
Parkinson's is a neuromuscular degenerative disease with no cure at this time. What that means is there's a brain function that changes because of loss of dopamine, and there is muscular changes that occur throughout the disease, and they start usually as very minor tremors, and they go all the way to complete inactivity. So it's a very difficult disease to manage, and it's a very complex disease to treat. And for that reason, raising funds is critical because the research components are so important to bring new and different treatments into the marketplace. Today, the main drug that's used is called levodopa. It has been in use for 60 years, and nothing has really replaced it to date other than a tool called deep stimulation brain surgery. And what that does is it puts electrodes into the brain that help to redirect or support the natural function of the brain. And so the people who get that surgery, and it's a very tiny number of people, are able to function better because their brain is, if you like, retrained to prevent further deterioration.
Now you have a lot of knowledge in this topic.
I live with it every day,
Dan. Oh,
you
live with it. Okay, I was about to lead into that. How did you get into this, and what's your... obviously, you live with it. How... In your experience, how is living with Parkinson's?
Complicated. I was diagnosed in 2021, and like most people, I had no idea I had this disease. It was completely a shock to me. So the first reaction to hearing that you have the disease is usually panic, followed by anxiety, and sadly, that often leads to depression. And many people who have this disease suffer from something called apathy, which is kind of a lack of willingness to live because they've come to the conclusion there's no way to get better. I'm living a dismal life. I have no hope. I have no chance. I am just giving up right now. So that's a really big issue in this community. However, there are all kinds of wonderful tools available through Parkinson Canada, which is the national organization that supports people with this disease and their caregivers. And so people can call Parkinson Canada and get support. They can go to a local database here in Northumberland that allows them to find, for example, physiotherapists or psychologists or nutritionists or pharmacists or massage therapists. It is better for these people to work with a team. It's very hard for somebody with Parkinson's to live alone. And if they don't have a caregiver, their life is way more difficult.
So then how did you initially navigate that? You talked about the panic, you talked about the anxiety. How did you get through that? Did you get yourself set up with a team? What was your process?
I did get a team eventually, not obviously within the first week or two, nothing like that, but it took time to put a team together. But more importantly, I was in touch with one of the counselors at Parkinson Canada, and she was absolutely phenomenal in the way she helped me and supported me. I was usually in tears when we spoke because I was panicked. But she gave me all kinds of materials and guidance and support and encouragement. I call her my guardian angel. And she's still working there, and she's still very, very helpful to people who do not know what to do. The strange thing, Dan, is at that point in time, you don't even know which questions to ask. You're facing something so new and so unexpected. You don't know how to say, I need X, because you don't know what X is. You don't know how to put yourself in a place to learn when you don't know what questions to ask.
Before you got diagnosed, were there some symptoms or some things you noticed that might be off and that you needed to go to the doctor to get checked out? What went through the initial process before getting diagnosed?
Well, usually the most common way that it's diagnosed is there are tremors, and you may have seen people with tremors and they look like they're shaking. They have no control over that. And by the way, there's no pain associated with it, which is nice. But my GP said, you know, we should at least look at this and see if there's something more. And so she sent me to see a neurologist. However, the sad story in Canada is there aren't enough neurologists to treat the people who are being diagnosed. And you have to remember, this is a disease of the elderly. So the number of people who are coming down with Parkinson's, if you like, is growing rapidly. Currently in this area, it takes 2 years before you can see a neurologist. That's the wait time. Now imagine you know or you think you might have a very serious disease that needs immediate treatment, and you have to wait 2 years to find out if that's true or not. It's absolutely horrible, but it's the truth. So there's a very big demand for neurologists, and there aren't enough here. Parkinson Canada actually now is offering scholarships and financial funding to help people studying neurology to try and get more people into the field.
How do I get involved if I want to do a walk or raise some money? How would the public get involved?
There's a website called superwalk.ca that gives you all the information you need. But in addition to that, there are people here in the community who are members of a support group, which is a group that meets monthly in Coburg to help people with Parkinson's and their caregivers. And anybody in that support group or anybody who is connected with Parkinson's in this community, including myself, because I'm an ambassador for Parkinson Canada, they are all available to help and guide and support people who want to participate on Sunday, September the 7th at 10 a.m.
So what is the goal, the fundraising goal for this walk in Northumberland?
Well, last year across Canada, there were 33 locations where the Superwalk was held, and approximately $3 million was raised across Canada on that one day of the walk. So obviously, we all try every year to try and increase the amount of funds that are available. But the truth is, you know, people are living in a different economy, and it's hard for people to come up with extra money. So we just ask people to give what they can, even if it's $5 or $10. Every single dollar matters, and everything that is generated in that walk is applied to research and developing programs that help people living with the disease.
Where is the walk taking place this year in Northumberland?
It's at the Pavilion, the Lions Pavilion, on the waterfront in Coburg.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, August 28th, daytime high of 22 degrees with periods of cloud throughout the day. Otherwise, it's going to be quite sunny. There is a 59% chance of precipitation in the forecast, however. Friday, August 29th, daytime high of 21, beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Saturday, August 30th, daytime high of 22 with a mix of sun and cloud in the forecast. Sunday, August 31st, 23 degrees, sunny and beautiful. And then moving into the start of September, Monday, September 1st, daytime high of 24, feeling closer to 25 with a mix of sun and cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.